The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Campbell McGrath, and he is going to say hi with an opening poem.
The poem's called Plums. I'm sitting on a hill in Nebraska in morning sunlight, looking out across the valley of the Platte River. My car is parked far below in the lot behind the rest stop wigwam beyond which runs the highway. Beyond the highway, stitch marks of the railroad, the sandy channels and bars of the Platte, a slow wide bend of cottonwood saplings metallic in the sun. Beyond the river, a hazy Cézanne-like geometry of earthy blues, greens, and browns fading at last into the distance. Barrel music rises up from the traffic on I-80, strings of long-haul truckers rolling west, rolling east, the great age of the automobile burning down before my eyes, a thing of colossal beauty and thoughtlessness. For lunch, in a paper bag, 3 ripe plums and a cold piece of chicken. It is not yet noon. My senses are alive to the warmth of the sun, the smell of the blood of the grass, the euphoria of the journey, the taste of fruit, fresh plums, succulent and juicy, especially the plums. So much depends upon the image. Chickens, asphodel, a numeral, a seashell, 1 white peony flanged with crimson, a chunk of black ore carried up from the heart of anthracite to be found by a child alongside the tracks, like the token vestige of a former life. What is it? Coal. A touchstone polished by age and handling, so familiar as to be a kind of fetish, a rabbit's foot worn down to bone, a talisman possessed of an entirely personal, associative, magical significance. Why do I still carry it? That moment in Nebraska. Was it the first time I'd been west? First time driving across the country? Was it the promise of open space, the joy of setting out, the unmistakable goodness of the land and the people, the first hint of connection with the deep wagon ruts of the dream, the living tissue through which the valley of the Platte has channeled the Mormons and the 49ers, the Pawnee and the Union Pacific, this ribbon of highway beneath a sky alive with the smoke of our transit, the body of the past consumed by the engine of our perpetual restlessness? How am I to choose among these things? Who am I to speak for that younger vision of myself atop a hill in Nebraska, bathed in morning light? I was there. I bore witness to that moment. I heard it pass, touched it, tasted its mysterious essence. I bear it with me even now, an amulet smooth as a fleshless fruit stone. Plums. I have stolen your image, William Carlos Williams. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold.
The voice of Campbell McGrath. This is from Road Atlas, and that was a good poem to signify the book, because in the book there's you honor poetry directly and indirectly and other poets, and you also travel throughout the world, your interior world and the world of geography. And there is in that poem, I guess William Carlos Williams is a goodwill poet, would you say?
Uh-huh, he is. He's a terrific poet. I mean, maybe the central American poet of the 20th century even. Possibly.
But the goodness of him.
It's exactly that, his good-natured kind of democratic tendency that makes him such a model.
And that comes through in that poem, I think. That's why it's an important poem. It's a happy to be alive thing. You have a lot of light in this book.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. I mean, I'm happy to be alive. I write poems usually out of happiness, joy, or even at least kind of interest in the world around me as a documentary interest in the world. And I think Williams did that. You know, many poets have different takes on the world, but mine is external, looking at it and wanting to kind of get its actual flavors into the poems themselves.
And that has done you a lot of good. You have been awarded a lot of acclaim for the way you look at the world and write about it. 5 books out. We talked about Road Atlas, Right on the shelf, brand new, is Florida Poems, and there are three previous books. What are their titles?
Capitalism is the first book, and then American Noise and Spring Comes to Chicago.
You have great titles. Road Atlas is HarperCollins.
Right, Echo Press, HarperCollins.
And so is Florida Poems.
Yes.
Right. Campbell came here to us from Florida today, and he lives in Miami Beach, and he's going to have to tell us what that feels like, teaches there, and is my second MacArthur Fellow I've ever interviewed on tape at 2,000 Poets.
Wow, well, that's
they've
that's
been avoiding me.
Privilege.
Charles Simic was the other.
Mm-hmm.
And for the world, I don't know how many people know that this is an honor that is such a distinction. I said to Campbell, every morning when you wake up, you must think, nothing can go wrong. I'm a MacArthur Fellow. I mean, it's like being dinged by the fairies, like being blessed by the universe. Now, am I overstating it?
I think perhaps slightly overstating it, but it's certainly a wonderful honor. You know, it's philanthropy at its purest. They just call you up out of the blue on the phone one day and say, you know, unbeknownst to you, we were contemplating giving you this, and now you've won it, and you get a lot of money and a lot of prestige, acclaim, and validation.
And you thought it was a telemarketer, and you weren't even going to take the call.
I remember when they called. I was babysitting my son Jackson, who was a one-year-old. And who was like screaming and carrying on about something in my arms, you know, kind of wouldn't stop. And I'm trying to talk on the phone, and they're trying to tell me I've won MacArthur. And I was like, hold on just a second. I really can't do both of these streams simultaneously. Let me figure out what's happening here. And they, on the other end, thought that was a real hoot at the MacArthur that I was there, you know, babysitting my son who wouldn't stop complaining and being a handful for me. So
I would have loved to have been the person to call you. Because I was a program officer at NEH, and I loved calling people and telling them they got grants. It is such a wonderful feeling.
I think they like it too. You can tell.
I want to know.
They're very happy with that moment of just being able to bestow this, you know, after whatever. I mean, in other words, they do a significant behind the scenes, you know, paperwork and sorting out their choices, obviously. But then when it's down to the actual picking up the phone and calling, you can tell they had a real sense of. There were, you know, could tell there were all the officers, as you say, were kind of in the room waiting to hear, you know, what the person would say or how they would take it or how it would go.
And we're talking to Campbell McGrath. We don't know. It's a sizable sum of money. We're not going to be so crass as to say
sure.
it, but it's given so that you can live on it. You can use it yearly, as Charlie Simic said, to become and continue to be creative, and that's what it's supposed to be.
That's right. It's like a 5-year thing, and it. I mean, you know, when they originally invented it was supposed to be enough to really fully live on for a 5-year period of time, but it isn't really. Although since I won one, they've actually adjusted their numbers, but it's for a lot of money and a lot of validation, and it really does just reconfigure your life for those 5 years. It gives me much easier. You know, I have to juggle the three balls of raising a family with small kids and working as a professor and writing, and that's a lot. And
but
this,
think of
you know,
all of the poets.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of poets out there.
Thousands.
I've certainly interviewed 2,000
yeah.
of them. And how were you chosen? I mean, you sent a picture of yourself.
It's a real secret. I mean, they're, you know, one of the things that has preserved their the good feeling that there is about that award is that it's a non-politicized process. You
but
can't
somebody
compete.
Read your work. I mean, let's imagine it.
Well, they say it's like the FBI in reverse. Someone gives you their name and they build a file on you, but they're doing it for a good purpose. In other
so
words.
You think someone gave that?
Oh yeah, they
name.
Ask people. They have distinguished nominators who are secret, and they I think you know switch around at the higher echelons of whoever they consider, and they say please give us a nomination. And then once you're nominated, they do a year or two of researching you and assembling a whole file on whatever the critical opinion. I think they solicit outside letters from who they think might be an expert judge or whatever. And then if they think, well, yeah, this guy's package is one of the ones we're interested in, they put you forward, and there's a board of the board. I mean, again, it sounds like it's a real elaborate, you know,
KGB.
Kind of medieval sounding institution. But I think that they've done a very good job at. Erecting those walls so as to keep the process
they
from being
have.
Influenceable.
Nobody
you don't
knows
know,
how it happens.
I don't to this day, and it's been more than 2 years, and I have no idea who nominated me or who the people involved in giving me this were. I wish I knew, only so that I could, you know, thank them.
We're talking about the MacArthur Fellowship, And this is Campbell McGrath we're talking to. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and he's won several others, 15 other national awards, and I intend to read every one of them before the hour's over, or else we will read poetry. Which shall we do?
I think poetry is far more interesting choice.
Let's go.
The next poem I want to read, we're talking about traveling, and we're talking about my last book, Road Atlas, which, as the title suggests, a lot of which has to do with travel around the world, but especially in America I travel, and I just, in fact, have finished a two-week road trip with my wife and two kids up here from Florida. This is a poem called Manitoba, a poem about driving in the West, the Great Plains, and traveling with a friend about, I guess, 20 years ago now. Manitoba. 10 miles in, we came upon the locusts, road striped and banded with them, fields plagued and shadowed with their mass, fulsome, darker than cloud dapple, slick as shampoo beneath the wheels. In the next town, we stopped to scrape them from the radiator with our pocket knives. Grasshoppers, their bodies crushed and mangled, scaled and armatured, primordial, pharaonic, an ancient horde of implacable charioteers, black ooze kicking the headlights to blindness, mindless yellow legs still kicking. Not much in that town. Sidewalks grown with goldenrod, grain elevator on the old railroad siding. Not much besides wheat and gasoline, the ragged beauty of the heat-painted prairie, wind with the texture of coiled rope, the solitude of the plains unrolling beyond limit of comprehension. It was time to hit the road. Charlie grabbed a root beer. I topped up the oil. We hosed out the dead and drove on.
Lee Young Lee says, these poems are huge, compassionate, celebratory. The reason I say that is it's not as easy as it looks to write a travelogue, which is poetry. People think, oh, you know, what a great subject. I'll just chart what I do as I drive along. That is not all that's going on here.
To write travelogues was really one of my conscious intentions in this book. I mean, throughout my career, I have a number of poems that are about travel, a number of poems just named after places, from Los Angeles to Memphis to Amsterdam to places in Brazil, the South Pacific. But this time I wanted to take travel and kind of pull that theme out of my work and really make the whole book focus on it. That's actually kind of a dual theme in this book, travel and fatherhood, because that's where I am in life. But so I wanted to kind of think about just that thought. Well, what can we do to make a poem be a travelogue as its, you know, real essence, rather than just as a kind of incidental fact in the poem? So some of these are almost trying to be travel poems in a real conscious way and work different. You know, that one's a real short one, Manitoba, just a little vision of that one moment of driving a road covered with locusts and coming to a small town, then have to, you know, scrape them out of your car. Others are more complicated, trying to invoke a longer series of events, a history of places, a narrative. And I was really feeling my way through that. How do we get travel into poetry?
We have to talk about the form.
Yeah.
Because you were very... I was thinking today, coming in on the train, how it's better not to be head-on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
How it's sometimes best just to step aside and to do it that way. And this is a step-aside book. It's very liberal in what the line can be, and it's very inspiring, I think, to other people to write in a way that is fresh.
Yeah.
There's certainly the lyricism, there's certainly the meter, actually. But somewhere along the line you said, I'm not going head on.
Yeah,
I'm going to
yeah.
do this exactly the way I feel like. And if people don't like prose poems,
right.
I don't care if it doesn't get published. It has that wonderful
right.
feeling of autonomy.
Well, that's I said I was pulling this book out as the theme of travel, but also I was pulling out the notion of exploring prose poems. I've always written them. They're in my first book. They're in all my books. But this time I said, well, I want to work with that one form throughout a whole book and try different variations on it, from little paragraph-like block prose poems, which are maybe more traditional, if there is a tradition in prose poetry, to more broken open prose forms, writing in something that's neither a line nor a paragraph, but somewhere in between, a kind of prose fragment or strophic, open-ended, poetic kind of pieces on the page.
And you do something wonderful. You do fragments sometimes?
Yeah, I've just fragmented, you know, kind of dismantling of sentences into fragments, not trying to turn them into lines in a traditional sense, certainly not a metrical sense, not even a free verse line, but something other than a line, but less than a paragraph.
That has to happen, though. The reader just has to know that people are breaking open things. We just have to keep knowing that, because otherwise poetry will just die forever.
I have my problem as a poet is that I really want to get the world into my poems in a very inclusive way. I mean, I really want to document the world, and I got to say, the lyric poetry is not a form perfectly designed to allow you to accommodate that. So I've always been butting up against the formal limits of lyric poetry and trying to say, well, what could I do to enlarge it? What can I do to enlarge the form to get my own particular and peculiar interest in American culture, history, landscape into the poem more, not to have to exclude that? So, you know, in this book it was to say, well, let's try more prose and see what that allows us. And I think it accommodates this travelogue, for instance, better.
Came out when?
1999. And a paperback is just coming out in 2001, rather, I'm sorry.
I was wondering how much that influenced the MacArthur. I know I'm hung up on this award.
No, this book came out post-MacArthur, immediately post-MacArthur. It really won the MacArthur for my prior book, Spring Comes to Chicago.
That's what I wondered.
That's the book that's really, as you, in our talk here, we've said we would winning awards and acclaim. It really all stems entirely from that book, which was my third book, and a book in which the book is called Spring Comes to Chicago, but 90% of that book is the long poem called The Bob Hope Poem, which is a 70-page poem about Bob Hope. And once you write a 70-page poem about Bob Hope, you know, you've forever declared that you're either, you know, a real moron or a future MacArthur recipient.
Well, and, there's a Bob
you know, luckily
Hope,
for me, it's the latter.
The Library of Congress should certainly mount that poem. I think they have a Bob Hope something,
well,
retrospective or
something.
Well,
there should, you know, I mean, Bob Hope is, you know, very, very aged and very, very much on his, you know, last legs, has been one of the major, you know, American cultural icons of the 20th century, surviving into the 21st. So anyway, that's about Bob Hope, but it's about America and it's about all my concerns. But that was a way of expanding it, just saying, well, what if we just get really big? What if we go to 70 pages with the poem? Will that allow me to get everything I want to say into a poem? And then in the next book, I tried something different, trying to get it in these prose forms. And then the Florida poem book is a totally new set of forms.
He has won the Witter Binner Fellowship, and I think Pinsky appointed you that.
Yes, Robert Pinsky did appoint me that.
Do you know him very well?
I know Robert fairly well, yeah. He was a teacher of mine briefly when I was in graduate school at Columbia, mm-hmm. and just a person whose work I actually had read prior to that in college. And in fact, one of the models formally for the Bob Hope poem is his long poem, An Explanation of America. Not tonally, it's not really doing the same thing, but just in terms of a way you might talk about America.
Historically.
And, you know, his poem is spoken to a daughter, and mine kind of has an unborn son as its recipient. And how you kind of get a rhetorical stance to mount a big poem like that, it's something that he was one of my real models for.
Does he know that?
I think he does. I'm not sure if he remembers it. I've mentioned it to him. You know,
we have the Guggenheim, too. Do you have to be under 40?
For Guggenheim,
yeah.
I don't really know the parameters of Guggenheim. That one you actually do apply for. I think that I don't think there's any actual stipulated limitation, but they're looking, the Guggenheim Foundation is also looking for people in mid-career in their 30s or 40s.
Bob Hope couldn't get it.
I think if you're really, you have to, I mean, the way they phrase it is you have to have, you know, you have to have kind of done enough to demonstrate real accomplishment already in an art or a science or a, you know, field of inquiry, but not yet have, but still have the award be of great use to you. So it's mid-career. And that's, to be honest, I think these people are, I mean, it's amazing to be the recipient of so much. Well, I mean, the Bob Hope poem is a poem really decrying accumulated capital and, you know, the ills of our society in ways in which wealth has so many negatives. And here I am the recipient of, you know, of philanthropic wealth being thrown upon me for having written such a poem. There's a great irony in that.
The Kingsley Tufts.
Well, that was the first prize I won, and that was right. I mean, these all came within. It was basically one a year for 3 years there. It was a really amazing lightning storm. I think that I say lightning because there's a kind of lightning rod effect. Once you win one significant prize, in a way, you've brought yourself more to attention to the other institutions that might be granting fellowships or prizes. There's a kind of sense, oh, he won that, so maybe he's also worthy of ours. I think that can certainly help you. People feel, you know, when you haven't won any prizes, which I hadn't prior to that, I mean, any major ones, you can kind of feel frustrated because you say, well, look at this person. He just won this, and this. Why does he need three? Why doesn't he give me one? Now I'm on the other side of that equation.
And you want all of them, right?
Having won several prizes. And there really is a kind of way in which they build upon each other.
Howard Nemiroff said, bring them on.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's really no downside as the point of view to having won such things where you really are enabled to devote more of your time to writing. And that's the whole notion.
We are at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're talking to Campbell McGrath, and we've been reading from Road Atlas, HarperCollins. And are we going to go on to a new
poem? I'm going to do one more poem from Road Atlas, which will kind of segue us into the next thought. I've read two that are about travel, but let's read one now that's a family poem. This poem's entirely, it's a little prose poem, but it's really a dialogue. It's just two spoken voices going back and forth. The poem's called Rice and Beans. The voices, as I think you'll deduce pretty readily, are a father talking to a young son. Dad? Yes. You are a wimp. That's very nice. Thank you. Eat your grilled cheese. I say you are a little wimp. I learned that at school from a big kid. Of course. Tyrannosaurus Rex, king of the dinosaurs. Sam is not yet three. When he roars, I stick a spoonful of rice and beans into his mouth. Dad, did Rex eat ricey beans? I think so. No, he was a meat eater. That's right. They think he was a meat eater. Who? Scientists. Dad, yes. Does beans have bones? No. Do cheese have bones? No. Why do they change the name of Brontosaurus to Apatosaurus? I honestly don't know. Scientists know. They know, Dad. Yes. Probably. Drink some water, please. Dad, water does not have bones. True. Water does not have hands. Right. Usually, dogs have no hands. But Scooby-Doo have hands. Why, Dad? He's not a real dog. Did he die out? He's just a cartoon dog. Do Scooby-Doo eat ricey beans? Cartoon ricey beans? No. Yes. Probably. I think so. Eat your sandwich. Dad, I know call you little wimp before. Rex call you little wimp. That's not a nice thing to call someone, is it? Rex is not nice. Rex mean. Sam roars and I stick a crust of sandwich in his mouth. Dad, can I have a cookie, vanilla cookie, please? You haven't finished your grilled cheese, have you? That's just the bones, Dad. Toast bones.
I love dialogue in poetry.
That's a hard, I mean, I always tell my students, you know, be careful, don't. It's very hard to get dialogue into your poems. And then, of course, you know, you go and write a poem like that and they read it and they get very mad at you. You told
but
us
still,
not to do that.
There is something very immediate about it that you can't take your eye away from the page. And if you get it right.
I don't know if the poem gets it. That poem was really an experiment. I mean, again, in a formal experiment to say, well, can I write a poem that's just dialogue with only a couple little tiny moments of exposition? I wouldn't have written a poem like that in a previous book. But because this book, Road Atlas, was about prose forms and trying and allowing the prose form to allow me to accommodate other kinds of things I hadn't gotten at, like travelogues, like a dialogue. That's exactly why I wrote it, was to say, well, can this form accommodate this? Because I don't think of previous forms I'd worked in, lineated kind of lyric forms, would have allowed me to just put a dialogue in.
You were in a very free place when you wrote this book.
I had written this book. This book was ready to be published when I won my MacArthur. But, yeah, I after writing the Bob Hope poem, was a kind of, you know, 7-year struggle to get this huge poem written. And I felt incredibly liberated after getting rid of it. I mean, that was like a burden I was carrying around. And then this was a free book to me, Road Atlas, a book I hadn't had to conceive that the poems, you know, I really did allow myself to just...
People must be walking through their kitchen or listening in the car radio and saying, what do these people do? This guy has spent 7 years writing a 70-page poem. I mean, who are these people? I can just imagine the world because it is such an unpublic art that mm-hmm. people wonder what's in it for you. You know, I've been hanging out with playwrights for the last week, and they wouldn't spend a minute on a poem because they want action. You know,
right,
they
right.
want to show it and shoot it. right at the same moment. There's something so exhibitionist about other kinds of writing, and something so humble about spending 7 years on a 70-page poem.
Well, yeah, I don't know if humble is really the right word. I mean, it's certainly the rewards are not external. That's true. It's not poetry is not in our culture a very public medium. It's got a growing readership and a very loyal readership, but it's a small readership. It's not going to be supplanting TV anytime soon. It is getting better. I think the poetry audience is unmistakably growing. We could talk about Billy Collins, the new poet laureate and the best read poet in America, as an example of someone who's really earned a very large readership through 30 years of writing really good poems. It certainly is a poetry readership, but it's not in danger of replacing Hollywood or TV as a real public medium in this country. So when you write poetry, I think you have to make peace with that right away. You talk about playwriting. I wrote a play when I was in college, and I was interested in playwriting, and I was interested in film. I think film is really the major public medium in our country. But they were very frustrating mediums for me because you don't really control the final product. You may write the play, but then you get this experience of having the actors actually utter the words in all different ways, and you had kind of heard them in your head, and the audience laughs when you thought it was sad, and they cry when you thought it was funny.
Did they produce your play?
Yeah, a student theater kind of in Chicago.
Usually that hooks somebody forevermore.
Really? Well, I liked the experience, and it was fun. It was interesting. I mean, I ended up doing the directing it, and I was really bad at that.
You should not have done that.
It was a terrible decision. It was, because it was my first play, you're much too attached to it. I couldn't have allowed any other person to do it. You know what I mean? I co-directed it with my wife, actually, who was not my wife at that time, who knew a lot about the theater, so was actually qualified where I wasn't. Anyway, the whole experience was interesting and fun, but convinced me that I wanted to be, to control the means of production. And poetry really allows me. You need to write a poem is a pencil and a piece of paper. Realistically, you can write the poem in your head.
This is true.
Really what makes it to me, that is its unique.
Linda Paston
magic.
Broke her leg, and she lay there in the snow. And she went over the poem until the ambulance got there, over and over and over. It's always something to do when you break a leg in the snow.
There you go.
My husband's a sculptor. He needs all this equipment,
exactly
all these
right.
things, and he has to put on
right.
leather, and it's just awful.
That's exactly what it is.
He's so jealous.
I think those are great arts. Even painting is relatively simple, but even so, you just get frustrated at the plasticness of these external medium. All you need is, the words are in your head. It's an entirely self-contained and, fluid thing to write poetry.
And you're a professor.
Yeah,
of English and creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you must teach more than creative writing.
Well, I do. I teach, but I mean, to the degree I can, I teach creative writing because that's what I do best, know best, and best able to teach. But I teach poetry, in a general way even though I teach poetry as literature, but I'm always trying to teach it from a pragmatic point of view of how will we as student writers use what we're learning to become better writers ourselves.
Who did you teach? Just give me an idea of introduction to poetry, modern poetry, and you might tell me the most far out poets you might present.
Well, to be honest, one thing I would do is present world poetry rather than just American poetry. I mean, in American poetry, American poetry is pretty easy because you can start with the two giants of Whitman and Dickinson, and then pick and choose.
So you do it chronologically.
Then. Well, no, I haven't done exactly what I'm talking about, but I'm talking about something I've never done, but could
perhaps.
And that's
perhaps, why you know
pressed.
So much about it.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, a great class that I've been preparing and haven't taught yet is a class on Whitman and Neruda, the kind of two great American poets, the North American Whitman of the 19th century and Neruda, who was very much a fan of Whitman's and influenced by Whitman, the great American poet of the 20th century, and of course a Latin American poet. But that kind of big external documentary writers, Whitman and Neruda, those are two great figures and two great poets. That would be a class I would
what
teach.
What a preparation.
Well, and of course, I teach in Miami, where the student body is majority Spanish speaking. I teach at Florida International University, which is really just the University of Florida at Miami. It's the big 30,000 student campus of the University of Florida in the city of Miami. And our students represent the city's demographics. It's a majority Spanish-speaking place. And therefore, teaching, my Spanish is bad, but it's fairly, I can read the, you know, I enjoy reading Neruda in Spanish with a little help from the English occasionally going back. But I'm not pretending to teach in Spanish, but the students can bring the Spanish to it at whatever level they have it, so it's enriching there. That's a great thought. But I would teach haiku, and I would teach Irish poetry, and I would teach a lot of contemporary. I have certainly taught classes that are just contemporary American mm-hmm. poetry, you know, reading Robert Hass and Louise Glick and Lee Young Lee and Anne Carson and a whole bunch of.
You think
great
you're
poets.
In the tradition of Irish poets?
No, I do not.
No.
Although I'm, you know, an Irish American, and spent last summer in Ireland and found that a wonderful experience and admire Irish poetry. I think that I couldn't be further from that tradition. The Irish poetic tradition, even today, is a far more tradition-bound one. You know, we have Seamus Heaney, who's probably the best poet writing in English, whose formal abilities are just unbelievable, and who, but I don't mean to belittle him by saying they're formal, because he's a great poet. But you know, that's
but
not,
it's not
the
Campbell.
Model. Well, it's not the
not
model
Campbell
of it. It's not even pick 10, I think, contemporary American poets, and none of them are, in that sense, traditional metrical poets. They're very diverse one from another,
he's
but none of them quite look
formal,
like that.
He's right.
And that's the tradition in Ireland. Poetry is very much held sacred in the country, and therefore I think it's a little more tradition-bound.
Campbell McGrath. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, which is a great place to be
yes,
for poets
it
and
is.
Poetry. We're going to move into your new book, and it's entitled The Florida Poems.
Just called Florida Poems, yeah.
And on the cover is a big orange.
That's true enough. This poem's called The Orange. How about that? We'll read that one. The Orange. Gone to swim after walking the boys to school. Overcast morning, midweek, off-season. Few souls to brave the warm, storm-tossed waves, not wild but rough for this tranquil coast. Swimming now, in rhythm, arm over arm, let the ocean buoy the body and the legs work little. Wave overhead, crash and roll with it, breathe, stretch and build, windmill, climb the foam, breathe, breathe. Traveling downwind, I make good time and spot the marker by which I know to halt and forge my way ashore. Who am I to question the current? Surely this is peace abiding. Walking back along the beach, I mark the signs of erosion, bide the usual flotsam of seagrass and fan coral, afloat from somebody's fishing boat, crusted with sponge and barnacles, and then I find the orange. Single irradiant sphere on the sand, tide-washed, glistening as if newborn, golden orb, miraculous fruit, in all that sweep of horizon, the only point of color. Cross-legged on my towel, I let the juice course and mingle with the film of salt on my lips and the sand in my beard as I steadily peel and eat it. Considering the ancient lineage of this fruit, the long history of its dispersal around the globe on currents of animal and human migration, and in light of the importance of the citrus industry to the state of Florida, I will not claim it was the best and sweetest orange in the world, though it was, O great salt water of eternity, O strange and bountiful orchard.
Happy to be alive again.
Yeah.
In Florida.
It's,
you know, that, mm-hmm. Lee Young Lee's poem about orange, is it?
Persimmons?
No, peaches.
Peaches.
The impossible.
Yes, he's got a peaches poem. He's got a famous persimmons poem. Fruit is interesting. I don't know why I'm writing poems about fruit. We've had plums today and the orange. I got another one about
they're
a key
lime. Wholesome.
I guess so.
And there's such a way of looking at the sensual.
They are. I mean, it's good. It's a great assignment, for instance, to talk about teaching poetry. I mean, a great assignment is to teach a very beginning poetry class to write about fruit because it is so sensual fruit that even, and one of the great, I think, lessons to try to get people to do in their writing is to write out of their sensory data, write out of your senses, write out of what you see, feel, taste, touch, smell. And often students won't understand that in the abstract, but as soon as you say it has to be about fruit, almost mandatorily, they immediately start writing very sensual, sensory poems, because you can't talk about, you can't experience the act of eating fruit without it being a very sensual act. But this is a poem, really, The Orange, about, it's both very much a true-to-life poem, and it's a poem about the fact that the world does sometimes roll poems up to your feet, as in this instance of finding an orange washed ashore, you know, just at your foot on a gray, kind of otherwise more or less empty beach, and how astonishing that vision of a bright orange in a gray. The notion of an orange floated up to you is so strange, that the orchard of the sea could bear such fruit. But really, that's that the world can offer up something as splendid as a single orange. And, you know, as an example in writing poems, it's sometimes to write a poem you have to sit at home in your library and think and kind of crack your head against a certain thought or a certain set of words and come up with it. And other times, just really the serendipity of the world presents you things. That's, I think, a good, you know, defense, if I could offer
one, for
writing
poems. It's such a good message to have that orange just roll up to you.
Yeah.
But I know I looked, I was getting out of the subway, and I thought, oh, somebody give me a message. And on the back of this girl's T-shirt, it said, life is good. I said, okay, I'll take whatever I can get. And it was that kind of thing. And you have somewhere in your work the line, I cannot believe in any other life than this.
Right.
That's certainly paraphrasing it.
Right.
You don't believe and you can't believe in any other life but this. And that puts quite a stress on you to love this one a lot.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't know if I, certainly I have a heart, I'm not a believer in abstract, extra-worldly visions, you know, whether they be traditional kind of Judeo-Christian ones or, you know, alien abduction ones, whatever they are. I'm just a kind of maybe, you know, reductively realistic person, and the world I perceive around me is the only world that I care to. I mean, I'm very interested in those other worlds. I feel like Ludwig Wittgenstein, who says, you know, the limits of my language are the limits of my world. There may well be these other worlds. I have no notion, but I just know that my sensory equipment isn't enough to get me there. So I just figure I might as well leave that. You know, I'm not going to put my energy into that.
In the third dimension, we're with Campbell McGrath. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, which is a great place to be for poets and poetry. And all of the millions of books and tapes and records, it's poetry's memory in the world is here. So let us add to it.
Well, we're talking about fruit, and I want to read this very short fruit poem. It's kind of a supplement to The Orange. This one's called The Key Lime. Curiously yellow hand grenade of flavor. Molotov cocktail for a revolution against the bland.
You've been to Key West?
I've been to Key West. And key limes are, you know, a real emblematic fruit of Florida. They're a kind of lime that really, they're a lime, but they're bright yellow and weird, and they have this peculiar flavor, and they make key lime pie, most famously. But
can
also
your wife make
people
it?
Do. Oh, she's never tried to make key lime pie.
Every time you make it, it's different.
Yeah. There's famous,
it's the hardest thing in the world.
There's famous places to get key lime pie, you know, all over Florida. I remember that, for instance, you know, Joe's Stone Crab in Miami Beach is a very famous Hallmark restaurant, and we had just moved to Florida, and there was a front page article in the Miami Herald, a man who had been responsible for making the key lime pie at Joe's Stone Crab, you know, for 60 years, had died. But that was a front page news story in Miami. In other words, so in part of the culture was the key lime pie at Joe's.
Because every restaurant claims to have won the national award.
Or key lime pie, yeah, of course, that's right. Well, these guys don't need to make any claims at Joe's. You know, predate all the competitors. So,
I think you love Florida enough to stay. You're finding rich material.
It's you know, for me, I grew up in the Northeast, and then I lived in Chicago for many years, and so I kind of feel acclimated in big northern cities in the United States. So the idea of moving to Florida seemed very, very odd when I moved there 8 years ago. My wife and I and our first son was born then, and our second son's been born in Florida. But we got there and we just love it in a weird way. I mean, it's a love-hate relationship in that Florida is a truly bizarre place and the way it's manages, or I should say mismanages itself. But its natural world is so gloriously beautiful, even though the experience of the natural world in Florida is also complex, because you can't help but appreciate its beauty even as you're visibly watching the natural world be destroyed around you in a way you aren't. In the Northeast, for instance, most of the destruction of nature and imposition of man's world has already been done. But in Florida, it's still very
You're
much a work
it.
In progress.
Mm.
So you can't help but have this huge ambivalence. But for me, it's been a fantastic place because I love it. And I, as a student of American culture and history and landscape, watching that process firsthand rather than being in an older environment has been really kind of revolutionized my thinking about
Perfect
the world.
Perfect for a poet.
I guess that's right. Or for a poet, at least, who's looking out externally at culture and the world. You know, it's real interesting that I think it is very fair to say that Miami, Greater Miami, is really far more of a Latin American city than a North American city. You know, as you drive, I mean, again, I spent the last 2 weeks driving from Miami up here to the Northeast, and, you know, you only have to go about 200 miles north of Miami to get to Orlando, but you already feel that you've left one whole world for another. I mean, Miami has more in common, I think, with, you know, Caracas, Venezuela, than it does with Orlando.
Well, let's hear some more. This is another poem.
Yeah, we'll get to Orlando. I think we'll
We're going
to
talk about Orlando.
Well, I'll leave that. We'll leave that for a moment. This is a poem called simply Florida, and it's about the name of the state. Florida was given the name by Ponce de Leon, who first, you know, cited it for the European, in the European sense, and named it that, or that was, you know, the name Florida derived from its name. So the question, though, is Florida, meaning flowery or flowerful, full of flowers. And the question is, was it named that because there are so many flowers in Florida, or because the phrase Pascua Florida refers to the Easter week, and it was during Easter week when they cited Florida.
Hmm.
So in other words, for a long time people said, oh, it's called Florida because it's so full of flowers. But really, historically, that's probably not true. But anyway, this is a poem that takes the notion that Florida is named for flowers, which are very showy, ornamental kind of plant aspect of plants, while the real kind of hardworking, diligent plants go unnoticed in the shadows. Florida. If they'd had a spark of wit or vision, it would be known today as Cloudiana, in honor of the mighty Alps and Andes assembled and cast westward as rain and thunder each and every afternoon. If they'd understood the grave solemnity of the sublime, it would be named for the great blue heron, for longevity the alligator, for tenacity, the mosquito, for absurdity, the land crab. If they had any sense of history, it would be called land grab. It would be called exploitationia, for the bulldozed banyans, lost cathedrals of mahogany and cypress, savannas of sawgrass and sable palm, mangroves toiling to anchor their buttresses, knitting and mending the watery verge. Beautiful and useless, flowers bloom and die in every season here, their colors dissemble, soft corpses underfoot. If there was any justice in this world, it would be named Mangrovia.
Our guest is Campbell McGrath. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Let's just have another poem, because I think that I'm getting a sense of this new book, and I believe all the listeners are hearing them one after another. You really get the understanding of the diction of the book.
This one is a love poem. It's called The Zebra Longwing, which is the state butterfly of Florida.
Oh.
It tells a little anecdote about butterflies coming to live in our backyard, which they did one winter when we waited for them to... Since the poem was written, we waited for them to return. They haven't returned in previous,
just
in,
that one
in subsequent
species?
Winters. That one species, a bunch of zebra longwings lived in the hanging roots of an orchid plant in our backyard. They nested there in a way they slept in these hanging roots. They would come back like at sunset, climb into the, you know, fly into these roots, grasp on, and go to sleep, and sleep there all night long. And then they would wake up in the morning. They were very late risers even. They had a very easygoing lifestyle, apparently. They woke up well after we did. So we'd wake up and the butterflies would still be there, sound asleep in the roots. And then...
You were blessed.
They would wake up and flutter off for the
did
day.
Did your other neighbors ever have something like this?
I have
this?
No idea. I haven't spoken to a naturalist about it, which I should. But I didn't know that butterflies did this. I still don't. I've never spoken with anyone who could tell me this was unusual. But there were, you know, a bunch of, maybe a dozen of them, dwindling to, you know, six or eight or four, and then they disappeared at the end of the season. And while I still see zebra longwings flying around, we haven't had them come back.
Well, we'll know what they look like from this poem.
The Zebra Longwing. 40 years I've waited, uncomprehending, for these winter nights when the butterflies fold themselves like paper cranes to sleep in the dangling roots of the orchids boxed and hung from the live oak tree. How many there are? 6, 8, 11. When I missed the spikes and blossoms by moonlight, they stir but do not wake, antennaed and dreaming of passion flower nectar. Never before have they gifted us in like manner. Never before have they stilled their flight in our garden. Wings have borne them away from the silk of the past, as surely as some merciful wind has delivered us to an anchorage of such abundant grace, Elizabeth. All my life I have searched, without knowing it, for this moment.
I love this new book.
Oh, well, thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
I like your addressing Elizabeth in it, too.
Well, I'm always delighted to write a love poem to Elizabeth. But
has a wonderful feel, this book.
This was this notion of, you know, Elizabeth and I making this journey together. It was a strange journey to uproot our life and end up in Florida. And, I mean, it's interesting because, of course, Florida is a land of immigrants, mostly from other lands, but, of course, also immigrants from the Midwest, as we were. But, you know, after having lived there a while, you get a sense of the visitation of, you know, it's luck.
We should make everyone buy the book.
Well, that's
Florida Poems.
Make it mandatory.
Yes. Go to your bookstore today, Florida Poems, HarperCollins. And if they don't have it on the shelf, then you just tell them the title and they look up the ISBN.
Right, sure.
And you can get, and then you can feel cozy even in February.
That's a good point, yes.
When you're in Maine.
Of course. The best time of the year, in Florida is the worst time of the year everywhere else. So it always works to our advantage to call everyone up in February and say, how's the weather up there?
What else are you going to show us about living there?
Well, I want to read a little bit longer poem called Benediction for the Savior of Orlando. Let me just say a few words. First, apologies to the people of Orlando, who I'm sure there are many good people in Orlando. but I can't help, although, again, I write primarily out of happiness and out of a kind of exploration of the American landscape. You can't help but sometimes be overcome by a feeling of less than complete happiness, as this poem does. I also, you know, apologize if a corporate sponsor of our event happens to be the Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. And finally, let's tell you that the poem ends with two voices speaking over the last 10 lines of the poem, kind of interpolated. The first, someone speaking over the public address system at a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant, and the second, a prayer for salvation. So when you hear two voices interspersed, you'll know that's the end. Benediction for the Savior of Orlando. Signs and wonders. Jesus is Lord over Greater Orlando, snake-tagged in cadmium on a vine-grown cyclone fence along I-4 southbound north of downtown is a credo that subverts the conventional wisdom that Walt Disney is the Messiah and his minions the christened stewards of this place. That the kingdom to come shall be Mickey's, that the bread of our communion will be proffered by ATM, and the wine quaffed without taint of sulfites or trademark infringement, all of which is certainly true and yet too pat, too much like shooting mice in a barrel when there are nastier vermin to contest, and purgatories far worse than Disney's realm of immortal simulacra suckled at the breast of Lake Buena Vista. There is, for one, Orlando itself, Orlando rightly considered, Orlando qua Orlando. Nobody anywhere could honestly propose Orlando as a fit model for human habitation. City with the character of a turnpike restroom, city with the soul of a fast food establishment, sanitized and corporatized, homogeneous and formulaic. Orlando is the holy land of the branded and franchised. Orlando is the Jerusalem of commodified delight. Orlando, Orlando, so many Orlandos I commence to feel downright Shakespearean. But here is no Rosalind to dignify our tale, no touchstone to transform its tragedy to farce. Because Orlando is the Florida I fear to conceive, Florida ordained like the antechamber to that afterworld where jackal-headed Anubis prepares his embalmer's instruments to pump our veins with tincture of liquid sunshine until we are reduced to somnambulant acquiescence, a citizenry mummified within the cambric of material satiety, within the gated stucco walls of economic segregation and the hairy stucco arms of armed response security. A people determined to rev our outboards and troll for bass in the shadow of the formglass temples to corporate profit, while the fill ponds grow heavy with duckweed and algae and the golf courses burn with viridian fire through seasons of rain and seasons of drought, and the metropolis spreads ever outward the bland picnic blankets of its asphalt dominion, landscape drained of spontaneity and glee, bones boiled free of communal gristle. Is it any wonder the children of this America rise up with guns to wreak a senseless vengeance? The very children that might have saved us, the ones we had relied on to assemble in fellowship and attend to councils of greater wisdom than those to which we have given credence. Perhaps the children were absent from school the day these lessons were offered. Or perhaps the lessons have been censored from the curriculum, or there was no curriculum, or the schools have been demolished to make room for the future, a serial cataclysm of vinyl and asphalt, a republic of bananas and banana republics, where cars are the chosen and credit cards the elect, where Judge Judy balances the scales of justice and the anthem of our freedom is sung by Chuck E. Cheese. Here I may testify with absolute conviction. Chuck E. Cheese is the diabolical embodiment of a nightmare, the bewhiskered Mephistopheles of ring toss, the vampire of our transcendent ideals. Every Chuck E. Cheese's erected across the mall lands of America is another nail in the coffin of human aspiration, and every hour spent in one takes 6 months off your life. No, 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 it's not a theme restaurant or family amusement center, but a vision of infernal despair enjoined in plastic flames. The clownish horror of the place is unspeakable, yet I feel that I must speak of it. For I have been to the birthday party of Emily, turning 5, the birthday party of Max, turning 8 or 9, of Max again, of David and Doris, of Myrna and Roberto. I can bear witness to its odors of chocolate milk and floor cleanser, the formica falsity of its processed cheese food pseudo-pizza, its banquet tables arrayed with pitchers of lurid orange soda, and the kids in the arcade room playing air hockey and whack-a-mole and teaching one another to cheat at skee-ball, to win a screel of coupons to redeem for tiny, chintzy prizes, the worst sorts of craftily packaged trash, stringless army parachute guys, malformed monster finger puppets, Chinese yo-yos that self-destruct at the flip of a wrist, a rainbow-colored peep show designed to entice the youngest among us to invest their lives in a cycle of competitive consumption, and then the animatronic hoedown commences its banjo jangle, the hairy rodent orchestra churring their cymbals on stage as the gray rat man emerges from his curtain redolent of mildew, the incubus, the secret sharer, Chuck E. Cheese himself. And the baby children scream in dismay, and the larger children gag with disinterest, and the parents pay no attention at all, while employees with the fear and candy-glazed eyeballs of medium-security inmates stutter their pre-scripted remarks over a public address system in whose interstitial silences one may discern the voices of the lost upraised in prayer. We're having a great day at Chuck E. Cheese. Hear us. Help us. Grant us benison. Pick up your food at the counter, PJ. Comfort and guide us. Lead us to salvation. Everyone loves family fun at Chuck E. Bestow the mercies of your blessing. Cheese for your safety. Wear shoes at all times. Upon our souls we beseech thee. Last call for pickup, PJ. Last call. Lord of our fathers, almighty God.
Campbell McGrath. What is the definition for libelous, scandalous?
Scandalous, libelous, none of the above. This is simply documentary art.
That's right.
This is just going out into the world
with
your eyes open.
I will document your art. I've been there.
It's not personal. I mean, you know, the point is Chuck E. Cheese, you could have picked 10 other places and said they're just as bad. It's just that you have to pick something to talk about the culture. You know, Orlando is a kind of mega
Chuck E. Cheese.
Vision as a mega Chuck E. Cheese. And Orlando, I have some sympathy with because it's not all one thing. Chuck E. Cheese, I have little sympathy with because the product it offers is not a very quality one. And really, the values it's selling are values of mindless consumerism at its most grotesque. And
grotesque,
the target audience
is not
adults who are free to make their own choices, but tiny, easily influenceable children.
You're well known for not only your love and evaluation of popular culture, but your criticism of it and your capitalism poems.
Yeah.
Some 45 poems or something?
Well, we're up in the 50s, yeah. My first book was called Capitalism. I started writing these poems when I was in graduate school. I mean, I write out of this huge ambivalence, not meaning a lack of strong feeling, but strong feeling on both sides. I have this huge love for America and its institutions and its place and the people, and this huge, you know, anger or desire to point out some of these foibles. What I get mad at is in America is its lack of introspection, that we so happily accept the kind of TV commercial visions presented to us. And I feel that, you know, poets are a good situated maybe ideally to kind of talk about some of this.
I think they've been called the conscience.
And that's not a traditional role in America, but
we need
I'm glad we are taking that role on now.
We need a poem which says goodbye to everyone who has been listening to you.
Great.
And so what will that be?
I'm going to end with another little poem about Florida called, again, just Florida, a poem about its, at a simpler level, about its beauty and the still potential paradise that underlies the strip mall facade.
Is this the title poem?
No, the book is just called Florida Poems.
And you
there
have
are
some poems, several, a lot of poems named Florida.
There are several poems in it just called Florida. There's a longer poem called The Florida Poem, kind of modeled on, you know, the Bob Hope poem. That's a long exposition on Florida's culture, myth, and history. This is a simpler, paradisal vision of Florida. Florida. Paradise must resemble this realm of clouds, birds, and flowers. Red woodpecker in the royal palm. So too in that forum shall trees uphold the firmament. Mockingbird in the neighbor's garden. Wild green parrot in the grapefruit tree. Twisted of years, stretching its scaly neck across the hedge. Strange to know this branch has grown precisely thus to yield its shapely fruit unto my hand. So shall the limbs of that eternal orchard be laden. Hibiscus, ixora, alamanda, oleander. So shall every flower be given voice. There, too, below, the billows of the sea. Above, the reefs of dawn and sunset. Thunderheads risen like the fists of immortals, celestial cumulus like the bearers of something immense held dangling. Perfume of jasmine, egret in moonlight, trade wind through the jacaranda, nor night shall mask their glory, nor darkness still the turmoil of our senses.
Look at those line lengths. You'll just do anything for a cheap thrill.
That's it. Poetry as cheap thrill.
Campbell McGrath, what a pleasure.
Thanks very much, Grace. A great pleasure to be here.
It's been fun. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and the program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. We want to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri.